Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to this lecture to celebrate, if that's the right word, but I think it probably is, to celebrate the 500th anniversary of the publication of Machiavelli's The Prince. Before I introduce our speaker, I'll just say a few words about the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society, which sponsors occasions such as this in collaboration with the Center for Sociolegal Studies and Wolfson College. This is a coming together of the three institutes to provide a forum in which we can discuss issues such as the nature of constitutions or regulation or law and society in China and so on. Tonight, it's a great pleasure in particular to celebrate this famous book. Probably somebody keeps a list of the most famous, the most cited books. I imagine The Prince is pretty high up on that list, but probably also misquoted more often than quoted. So our speaker tonight will provide us with a more reliable approach, I am sure. Being here in Oxford in England, it's interesting to note that our own political philosopher John Locke, who was a student of Christchurch and wrote many of his works here in Oxford, has been referred to as the English Machiavelli. So we'll see whether there is any resemblance between the Niccolò of Florence and John of Oxford. That might come out in the discussion. There's also, of course, a quite strong link between Machiavelli and Thomas Hobbes. So it will be interesting to hear our guest speaker tonight offer some sort of assessment, some sort of a re-evaluation of the usefulness, of the relevance, of the importance, perhaps, of The Prince today. And I think he will concentrate on The Prince instead of the Discorsi, which is the partner, the twin book of Machiavelli, as you'll know. Very different in some respects, very similar in others, but I think our speaker will concentrate on Il Principe. So let me now introduce Professor Paolo Carta, who is Professor of History of Political Thought at the University of Trento, in the Faculty of Law and Department of the Humanities. He has his doctorate from Perugia and has been a visiting scholar at Columbia University and at the ENS in Paris. He's director of the journal Laboratoire Italien and author of the section of various other intellectual activities and movements, including being a fellow of the Italian Academy for Advanced Studies in America, which is based at Columbia University. Now, I won't go through his list of publications except to say that if anybody knows about Machiavelli, it would be Paolo Carta. He has a very long and impressive list of publications mainly concerned with Machiavelli or with contemporaries of Machiavelli. Although I can't resist noting that he has also written a book on Winston H. Auden, which does seem a little out of step with Machiavellian approach to life, but nevertheless. Anyhow, Professor Carta, it's a pleasure to welcome you here to Oxford, and we look forward to your discussion.
Thank you, Professor Galligan. I would like to thank all the organizers of the Book Colloquium, the Foundation for Law, Justice and Society, and the Wolfson College. It is a great honor for me to have been invited to speak of Machiavelli's The Prince on the occasion of the 500th anniversary of his composition. As we all know, the letter from Machiavelli to his friend Francesco Vettori, which announces the composition of a work, the Principatibus, on principalities, is dated December 10th, 1513, tomorrow. Speaking today and here of The Prince is a way of bringing the work of Machiavelli home. In fact, our knowledge of The Prince and his sources owes much to the work of Lawrence Arthur Bard, a teacher of Repton, an Oxford graduate who at the age of 28 in 1891 published right here is annotated edition of Machiavelli's The Prince. Barthes' comments remain, in many parts, still unsurpassed. I would like to talk about The Prince as a work dedicated to political judgment. I will expose first some topics of The Prince, and secondly, I will bring you to your attention an example to illustrate the origin of Machiavelli's realistic way of judging. My contribution may appear at times a bit too Guicciardinian rather than Machiavellian. In recent years, my research has focused primarily on the work of the friend of Machiavelli. For me, therefore, to speak of the relevance of Machiavelli's The Prince also means speaking of the issues that he shared with Guicciardini. They dealt with real and concrete problems that required realistic and concrete answers. Today, we do not have to answer the same questions, but their answers may clarify something of the genealogy of our own, as it has been written by Kirsten McClure, talking about John Locke. There is no doubt that above all, the writings of Machiavelli, which were largely circulated, constitute a real turning point in the history of political thought. The strength of The Prince is that it can be considered as a work that explores leadership in a broad sense, but it provides the people tools to understand their leaders and to judge their leaders. I think this is due to the extraordinary ability of the author to make political judgments and to the process by which they were formulated, relying on examples and particular cases. Although Machiavelli was not without a certain capacity of predictive accuracy, his judgment did not necessarily correspond with the political calculus. He was, in fact, quite interested in understanding the reasons that led a specific prince, or more generally, a political actor, in a particular context and in a certain conditions of the times, to act in a certain way. He aimed to verify if those reasons were carried out with a view to an end, or if they could be taken as examples to imitate or avoid. The end, or rather the effect, for a prince is always the foundation and the maintenance of the state. In his letter to Vettori, he wrote that he wasn't ashamed to speak with those ancient men to ask them the reason for their actions, and hear their replies. This attitude reveals the meaning of his work and its relevance. When we talk about a prince, we have to keep in mind only this particular regime, the principality, even if it would be reductive to attribute all the Machiavellian analysis only to the government of one person. The explicit evocation of Savonarola or allusion to Piero Soderini, the standard bearer for life of the Florentine Republic, are sufficient to understand that even the failed leadership of the latter deserves to be included among examples to be avoided by a prince who must found and maintain a state. Founding and maintaining a state are the two main topics of Machiavelli's Prince. He is, as has been said, appears as an analytical study on innovation. The Prince deals with the different kinds of principalities, the ways by which a private citizen becomes a prince, the militia, those qualities that the prince should have or not have, and in any case shows to have. And it ends with an exhortation addressed to a prince to bring the flag of a confederation capable of freeing Italy from foreign occupation and of ending the Italian wars. The letter is a recurring theme at the time when Machiavelli writes. We do not forget that the whole life of Machiavelli is marked by the constant presence of war in Italy. He belonged to a generation that can be retracted with the words he wrote to Guicciardini on January the 3rd, 1526. Always, as far back as I can remember, war has either been going on or has been talked about. This makes it clear why we must place the writings in a context of conflict and not of peace. In The Prince, the foundation of a state is also seen in a broader context of its necessary maintenance. This attempt reaches perfection with the constitution of a virtuous political entity, able to survive for a long time even after the death of its founder. To achieve this goal, the Roman legal lesson imposes the need to join good laws and good arms. These two terms are the cornerstones of the Machiavellian thinking. As he writes in the chapter 12 in The Prince, he leaves out the reasoning on laws and to speak of arms. As Sheldon Whelan has pointed out, the work of Machiavelli also reveals a kind of economy of violence, of economy of force, which distances him from the humanist tradition. Machiavelli was aware of this. His thought represents the culmination of a process already well beaten by the legal tradition that had developed its ideas about the imperio and about the power de facto. This tradition even dealt with the role played by providence and by fortune in becoming prince from being a private citizen. It was a path that Machiavelli, the son of a lawyer, should not have ignored. These aspects, however, are for him nothing but the framework of his study on principalities, which he feels of ancient examples, and especially of experience, his own political experience, his own life. In the case of the prince, everything assumes, however, the course of a real short circuit, when the general case is paced to a concrete example, no longer presented in the context of a chronicle or a history, but into a treaty that has also a specific educational purpose. We know The Prince as a work written by Machiavelli post Res Perditas, after the collapse of the Republic, of which he was a public servant, and it was dedicated to Lorenzo de' Medici, the future ruler of Florence. In his dedication to Lorenzo, Machiavelli declares to write a treatise to give you the capacity to be able to understand in a very short time all that I have learned and understood in so many years and with so many hardships and dangers for myself. In his letter to Vettori of December 10th, he had emphasized that should anyone be glad to have the service of one who is full of experience at the expense of another. He was a skilled man with experience and knowledge. For those times, he could claim to belong to a small elite of citizens. His words nonetheless raise a question that is very interesting in thinking about the role played by jurists in politics. Can a new government do anything without the expertise and knowledge of the best and wisest men involved with the past regime? His friend Guicciardini, who found himself in the same situation of Machiavelli after the fall of the Medici regime in 1527, wrote about it. Whenever a country falls into the hands of a tyrant, I think it is the duty of good citizens to try to cooperate with him and to use their influence to do good and avoid evil. Certainly, it is in the interests of the city to have good men in positions of authority at all times. End of quotation. We don't have to forget this way of thinking. In a world of ever-changing regimes, from a republic to a prince who wasn't bound to the law, they were aware of their own ability to be a living limit to the power, even that of a tyrant. There is no doubt that when Guicciardini wrote his rule, he included also his friend Machiavelli among the wisest men of which the city would certainly have needed at any time. In his Prince, therefore, in addition to presenting his skills, Machiavelli makes Lorenzo understand that the glory, the supreme good in politics, in the public sphere, also involves the assumption of certain responsibilities. It does not recommend, but rather requires, that someone who, from being a private citizen, becomes prince, accept these responsibilities, up to the point of being willing to make, if necessary, a choice between himself and the world, between his soul and his country, as he wrote in a famous letter. Recalling a motto that went back at least until the War of the Eight Saints, in which Florence was opposed to the Pope at the end of the 14th century. This choice may seem paradoxical only to those who are not called upon to fill positions of responsibility. To assume the responsibility of guiding and governing a state may in fact require that you be willing even to resist the temptation of being good and the obstinacy of being called good. This may primarily depend on the necessity, as Machiavelli had learned from Aristotle's Nicomachean Ethics. The necessity can compel virtuous men to act against what is commonly considered right, to ensure their own and others' safety for the salus populi, which Machiavelli evoked with Cicero in his discourses. Even if the prince recalls some formal aspects of the tradition of the mirrors for princes, it presents a new theory. The effect of this new theory was remarkable and probably went far beyond the intentions of its author. In a strictly legal sense, the interest Machiavelli put upon the prince gave birth to a new way of understanding the state. A new theory emerged, which saw the origin and sanction of law in the will of the state, wrote Harold Berman. In terms of the relationship between law and power, the prince can also be seen as a treatise of practical rules, or it would be better to say of examples taken from history that have as their goal to limit the exercise of power and strength, especially if we consider the time in which it was written. In this sense, it is not entirely out of place the attempt to present the prince as the work of a constitutionalist. This reading, though forced and selective, seems more plausible than another which has only seen the final exhortation as the fundamental reason for the work, reducing the importance of the analysis over the principalities and over the nature of the prince conducted in the previous chapters. The point is that there is too much life in those chapters, too much experience, too many judgments. The opening words of the prince are well known. Machiavelli makes no reflection on the legitimacy of power in a principality. The issue is not discussed in any way. As Guicciardini wrote, the situation on the peninsula was such that it was always suspected that someone wanted to establish a state and a signoria in our dominion. In The Prince, Machiavelli does not even present these kinds of issues that Guicciardini, as a lawyer and a jurist, proposes in his writings when he speaks of the state. Think of what he writes in the Discourse of Logroño, 1512. State and imperio are nothing but violence over subjects, occasionally mitigated by a pretense of decency, by a title of legitimacy. He is a jurist, and he looks at Italian states as real tyrannies, manifested and concealed. But in the case But in this case, there is something more. From a legal point of view, he could write in his political advice, in his ricordi, that political power, states, I say, because the word is stati, cannot be wielded according to conscience, to the dictates of good conscience, equity in legal terms. In fact, if you consider its origin, you will always find it in violence. Except in the case of republics within their territories, but not beyond. Not even the emperor is exempt from this rule, said Guicciardini, nor are the priests, whose violence is double, since they assault us with both temporal and spiritual arms. Guicciardini shares this idea about the political power even with other friends of Machiavelli. Francesco Vettori, for example, said that, freely speaking, every government is a tyranny. It must be also said that the term conscience, which for a lawyer as Guicciardini had a special significance related to equity and to the law, does not appear in Machiavelli. While it is constantly present in Guicciardini when, for example, following the chapter 5 of Machiavelli's Prince, he suggests a violent way to reconquer Pisa. In his dialogue on the government of Florence, he says, there is no better way than to regain a city accustomed to living in freedom than to destroy it. But he almost feels obliged to add, unlike Machiavelli, I didn't perhaps talk as a Christian. I talked according to the reason and practice of states. Nor will anyone be more of a Christian who rejects such cruelty but recommends doing everything is possible to take Pisa. Since this means, in effect, being the cause of infinite evils to occupy something that doesn't, according to conscience, belong to you. Anyone who doesn't acknowledge this has no excuse before God. I did so in order to talk realistically about things, as they are in fact. We can cope with this argument among ourselves, but we shouldn't, however, use it with others, nor where there were more people. It is a passage that also reveals the immediate effect that the prince had on its readers. One must ask, however, whether these ideas were shared when Machiavelli wrote The Prince, why The Prince has had the effect it has had. It should be stated that the writings to which I refer to didn't circulate. The Prince was read immediately after its composition. What probably astonished the early readers was to find a clear definition of what was commonly meant by political power through the presentation of examples not so much taken from ancient history, but above all from the contemporary Florentine history. Those examples were much more effective because they were presented by a direct witness. We find the Prince already in the hands of a nephew of Guicciardini, Niccolò, in 1517, who at the age of 16 wrote a letter to his father Luigi. Luigi was a Florentine commissioner in Arezzo, and Niccolò was concerned at the news of the movement of Spanish troops towards the city, because this might provide the Aretines with an opportunity to rebel. The young Guicciardini wrote that it would be necessary in order to make sure of them to do as Machiavelli says in his work The Principatibus, that the Vriotto da Fermo did when he wanted to become Lord of Fermo, and even then one could not be completely sure of the others. As we see, the example of Oliverotto and his slaughter of the first citizens of Fermo in order to become the lord of the city was used in a completely different context by Niccolò. Brian Richardson, commenting this letter, wrote, "One would like to know how Luigi reacted to receiving such advice from his young son." The chapter 8 of The Prince, in fact, is about those who attained a principality through crimes, and it is one of its more controversial chapters. Even in this extreme case, Machiavelli states that in taking hold of the state, one should examine all the offenses necessary for him to commit, and do them at a stroke, so as not to have to renew them every day, and secure men and gain themselves to himself with benefits. For him, there is no hope to establish a better state than to base it on the people, with good laws and good arms, in defense of its constitution. The new prince, however, should know that if fortune gives him the occasion to create a state, will he manage to keep it only by means of his virtue, which is not that of an ordinary citizen. Since the state, especially in the moment of its birth, is exposed to the threat of ruin, internal and external, will he necessarily be compelled to use force? The force, however, must be confined and limited to the initial moment, the foundation, and when it will be forced by necessity. Only if it is based on the people, in fact, the new state will be more solid. A new prince is required to think not only in the present and of the contingency, but also and especially to the future. This aspect is that by which the prince will be judged by his subject. The problem for Machiavelli is therefore to warn the prince of what could be the degree of force or violence that a people, given its characteristics, its customs, and its history, is willing to tolerate regarding the exercise of power of a new ruler. Basically, everything is related to purposes, better the effects, the results, that its government will yield. The judgment from the effects is something that even the legal, the medieval legal tradition took into account. Bartolus, for example, at the end of the 14th century, talking about the tyranny and the concealed tyranny that was the Medici regime for Guicciardini and for Machiavelli, said that it should be understood that just as one is seldom found who is completely healthy, indeed free from all bodily defect, so it is a rare thing to find a government that is completely devoted to the public good without some of the qualities of a tyranny. It would be more divine than human if rulers had no regard for their own advantage and cared solely for the common welfare. We call it a good government and not a tyranny in which the common and public welfare prevails over the personal welfare of the ruler. The one in which personal welfare is cared for more, we call a tyrannical government. It ought to be especially borne in mind when we consider proving whether someone is tyrant, a tacit tyrant. Moreover, even the jurist the jurists were willing to judge realistically the exercise of power. But talking about the prince, Machiavelli was bound to deal on those on these borderline cases. Take, for example, the case of Romulus, which Machiavelli considers in the Discourses 1-9. A prudent orderer of a republic, who has the intent to wish to help not himself but the common good, should contrive to have authority alone. Nor will a wise understanding ever reprove anyone for any extraordinary action that he uses to order a kingdom or constitute a republic. It is very suitable that when the deed accuses him, the effect excuses him. And when the effect is good, as was that of Romulus, it will always excuse the deed. For he who is violent to spoil, not he who is violent to mend, should be reproved. This idea of judging from the effect is precisely that somehow has defined the way we think about Machiavelli. We found it in the famous chapter 18 of The Prince. In the actions of all men, and especially of princes, where there is no court to appeal to, one looks to the end, to the result. So let a prince win and maintain his state. The means will always be judged honorable and will be praised by everyone. The key is the expression, where there is no court to appeal to. Sine appellazione, in Latin. He is thinking about the summa potestas, and probably he has in mind the role played by the dictator in the Roman Republic, which he analyzes in Discourses 133 and 134. It was a means and a remedy for the Republic. In the state of emergency, when danger was imminent, the Republic chose to appoint a dictator, according to Livy 2.18 and Digest 1.2.18, i.e. to give power to some one man to make decisions without consulting others and to carry them without anyone having the right to appeal. It was a temporary office, but Machiavelli thinks that a principality doesn't have this remedy. In the state of emergency, the prince only will act as the dictator, changing his nature, and without any court to appeal. He will be judged by his acts, by the effects, and he will be able to count only on himself. In this regard, Lawrence Barthes quoted some classical sources, such as Cicero and the well-known motto by Ovid, Exitus acta probat. I think that this issue can be seen even in the evangelical perspective presented by Savonarola in his sermons of 1498, delivered before Machiavelli. He required those who accused him of heresy to look at the fruit and judge him by the effects his preaching had made in the city of Florence. It is, however, Guicciardini that presents the question in Machiavellian terms within his dialogue on the government of Florence. In a passage that nobody seems to have linked before with the prince, when he made Bernardo del Nero say these words, "What in effect I want to say is this. If it were possible to have an illegitimate regime that was governed as agreeably and well as a loving regime, the fact of its being illegitimate would not alone make it worse than the other. For I believe that to know which type of government is better or less good, one should consider only its effects. And that an illegitimate government is usually judged bad because in the ordinary course of events, it usually produces bad effects. What do you say to this?" His interlocutor says that this is an impossible case, that something evil can be as good as something good. But we know that this is exactly the case of Machiavelli's prince. Bernardo replies, "If a legitimate ruler through ignorance or malice produced the same evils as someone who had usurped power, I don't think we would say that the state acquired by violence was worse than the other one. But considering the effects of both to be equally malign and pernicious, we could criticize one as much as the other. Isn't this true and indisputable? Instead of saying both were evil, we'd go farther and say that the legitimate ruler, who behaved badly, by his nature, without any need, was worse than the other, who did what he perhaps otherwise wouldn't have done, had he not been forced to do so by the nature of the state." In this way, I introduced with Guicciardini what it seems to me the most interesting topic of The Prince. The Prince, and this is why it is particularly interesting, even for the Republican and democratic thinking, is in many ways a work on political judgment. It is the work of a poet who does not hesitate to exercise his political judgment, who runs the risk of expressing it, trying to base it on those reasons by which he believes it should be judged in politics. To say it again in the words of his friend Guicciardini, he believes that between a cogent argument and an authority of a scholar who has written on the subject, you should also have the courage to choose the first. This was the art of the state to which he was trained in. This was also his profession. In the letter to Vittorio of December 10th, 1513, he writes that through his study on principalities, if it were read, one would see that I have neither slept nor played away through the 15 years I have been at the study of the art of the state. His experience as a servant of the Republic allowed him to exercise his particular talent to judge. We find the expression "I judge" or "I say" almost in every page of The Prince. We could say that The Prince is a sum of judgments derived from the examples and from the political experience of his author. This ability to judge is also what Machiavelli misses most about his previous political experience in 1513. Act politically and judge are the two elements that he tries to somehow replace with the writing of a political work. The Prince is another way to act and being in a public realm, being among men. After the fall of the Republic, the removal from office, the conviction for his suspected involvement in a conspiracy, and his exile, he had been prevented from thinking and reasoning of the state, as he wrote in a letter to Vittorio. His desire to resume the exercise of political judgment was encouraged by the letters of his friend. And this is one of the aspects, I believe, that makes The Prince still interesting today. His work asks us to reflect on and develop our way to exercise our political judgment. Isaiah Berlin, in this regard, asked, what is to have good judgment in politics? What is to be politically wise or gifted, to be a political genius, or even to be no more than politically competent? To know how to get things done, we presuppose that there is something to know, but what is this knowledge? Is it knowledge of a science? Are there really laws to be discovered, rules to be learned? Can statesmen be taught something called political science? Machiavelli and Guicciardini tried to elaborate their ideas about teaching this political knowledge, not only to a prince, but also to any political actor. The questions of Berlin concern, in fact, the exercise of every discretionary power. And since there will always be room in law as in politics for discretionary powers, these questions are ours. Discretion is a word that Guicciardini uses in all his works. As a jurist and a lawyer, he thought that discretion was even the best quality for a political actor. Even if Machiavelli didn't use the same word, we could say that since the etymological origin of discretion is judgment, as Professor Gallien pointed out, in particular, good judgment, The Prince is a work about the good political judgment based on reasons and reasons that respond to criteria of political reasonableness. Time is running. I cut some pages and left them for the discussion. Good. In Florence, the question of judgment was at the center of the sermons of Savonarola. In a sermon on Exodus, which belongs to that cycle, also heard by Machiavelli in 1498, and that will be at the origin of the parallel Moses-Savonarola of chapter 6 of The Prince, the friar, having to talk about the signs that God gave to Moses to approve his mission, was forced to make a digression and defend himself from the excommunication of Pope Alexander VI, who accused him of being a prophet without a sign. A legitimate authority, the Pope, was accusing the leader of the Florentine Republic, its founder, of not possessing any lawful authority. This issue divided the people of Florence, on which the Republic was founded. The magistracies took into account this topic, including the option to solve it through a trial by fire. Savonarola was declared a prophet without a sign, a prophet who couldn't show any sign of being sent by God. A prophet without a coat of arms, we could say, using a military terminology, an unarmed prophet, with the words of Machiavelli, who was ruined in his new order as soon as the multitude began not to believe him, and he had no mode for unlearning those who had believed, not for making unbelievers believe. This is my interpretation of this passage. Unarmed, in this case, means without an army, without an armor, and without a coat of arms. The sermon, delivered on March the 7th, 1498, was dedicated to the proper way to judge and apply a rule. What he said was that among physicians and lawyers, some are able to discuss according to the rulers and their books, but they know neither how to correctly judge a case nor how to cure a patient. Some others have judizio grande, a profound judgment, and those know both how to judge and to cure. In short, these physicians come straight to the point, to the case at hand. The same applies to lawyers. They don't have to be able to cite examples and references taken from the legal books, but they do have to know how to judge a particular case correctly. Being able only to discuss without judging means knowing nothing, and the same applies to the rulers of the republics in politics. Those who know how to judge say, this rule has to be applied here, in this particular case, but not to this other one, and sometimes they leave aside the rule to judge according to discretion. They understand everything and decide if a rule wasn't made for a particular purpose. It could be said that Machiavelli, even if he did not believe the prophet Savonarola, appreciated the man for his political judgment. He appreciated his versatility, his ability to adapt the words and deeds to the diversity of the times, and this was also a virtue that a prince should have. The political judgment remains the most interesting element of the approach of Machiavelli. He aims to judge with the examples taken from the ancient and contemporary history. It is a method Machiavelli expounded briefly in the preface to the Discourses. Machiavelli is interested in considering the method of two sciences, medicine and law, just as Savonarola, which according to him is essentially based on the imitation of the ancient physicians and lawyers. In other words, those sciences could count on the authority of a tradition. When Machiavelli says in the preface of the Discourses that civil laws are nothing other than the decisions, sentences delivered by the jurists, which teach our contemporary jurists how to render judgments, he has in mind the Justinian's Digest, and its practical, casuistic, and untheoretical nature. He correctly thought that the Roman jurists were essentially problem solvers, who worked case by case. If the jurists can be thought to judge according to a body of decisions derived from the history of their profession, why cannot rulers be taught to rule? Law, according to him, is a discipline that represents a successful use of the examples. To understand the realism of Machiavelli, I will propose to judge from an example, which will allow us to appreciate why he felt the need to develop a realistic approach to politics. It is often argued that as a diplomat and as a public servant of the Republic, Machiavelli was devoid of full political rights and excluded from any decision-making power. His were executive functions, and he could exert some influence as an advisor or expert. If this is true, we must, however, also add that a public servant, as well as any political actor, may be in a situation where being asked to exercise his own judgment, and, as happened to Machiavelli, to his decision is left the destiny of the Republic, the entire Republic. The case is this. After many attempts, at the end of 1507, the king of the Romans, Maximilian I, decided to come to Italy to receive the crown of the Holy Roman Emperor from the Pope and to put order into the territories of the empire. It was a declaration of war against the king of France, which it was said wanted to usurp the imperial crown. At the time, Florence is a republic. Nevertheless, is subject to the empire, but it is also an old ally of France. Piero Soderini, the standard bearer and the head of the republic, doesn't want to break this alliance. The Optimates, who are opposed to him, hope for the arrival of the emperor and the restoration of the government of the Medici to regain a prominent role in the new government of Florence. These are the two diverse humors that can be found in every city, as Machiavelli wrote in the chapter 9 of The Prince. In Florence, it is then necessary to send a diplomat to Germany to understand what are the emperor's intentions. Florence wishes to remain somewhat neutral in a war between the two potentates of Christendom. The Republic would like to pay a tribute to the emperor, so that by coming to Italy, he leaves the domains of the Florentine Republic intact. However, this payment couldn't put the Republic in serious difficulties due to its alliance with France. Even the simple solemn election of an ambassador sent to Germany could be interpreted by France as a violation of this covenant. So Florence prudently chooses to send an observer with no power to close an agreement. This was, in short, to save the Republic. Soderini chooses to send his most trusted collaborator, Niccolò Machiavelli, but the Optimates are against it because they consider him a tool of Soderini. They propose to send in his place Francesco Vettori. The task of Vettori is to observe what are the military forces of the emperor and whether he has enough help necessary for success. Only with certain information would they start negotiations for a payment of a sum of money. The emperor, in fact, at the time, was not a real sovereign, as Jean Baudin, following Guicciardini, pointed out in his Republic. The emperor depends on his electors, and also his army is bound to the promises, sometimes kept, sometimes not, of others. Moreover, his army should be paid. After his arrival in Germany, Vettori sends alarming letters to the magistracy of the Ten of War in Florence. He can't understand what is the true power of the emperor. The secretary of the Ten at the time is Machiavelli. Since the news coming from Germany are unclear, the Republic decided to send Machiavelli to collaborate with Vettori and begin negotiations for the payment of the emperor. It is the birth of their friendship. The condition to make this payment, however, is that it does not compromise the alliance of Florence with France. So Florence wishes the payment to be made only when the emperor's venture was already underway. For example, when the emperor's army has entered Italy, and when it is clear that he would be the winner. In that case, France will understand that the tribute paid by Florence was due to the natural debt that the city has with the empire. But the emperor is in need of money before starting the Italian mission, because with that money he maintains his military forces. He wants to be paid in Trento, a place, however, subjected to the emperor. On January 29, 1508, the Ten write to Vettori and Machiavelli that they do not intend to make a payment in Trento, but only in a city undoubtedly Italian. Only then will it be possible to affirm that the enterprise of Maximilian has begun. At this point, they add, "This is our intention. But if you believe that Maximilian's undertaking has already begun in Trento, and this creates a danger to our republic, then you may decide to do what you think is appropriate. All of this is left to your judgment. We do not want to pay the emperor at Trento, and what seems to us, however, a very serious event. We remind you to judge in the best possible way, and in the case of making payment, only if compelled by necessity. As you can see, everything is left to your judgment, with the intention that you do for the city the best that you can, evaluating every accident, pro et contra. It is good that you make judgment on the arrival of the emperor and that you resolve well and clearly." Vettori and Machiavelli should judge in advance of the successful enterprise of the emperor. From this judgment, that wasn't a simple calculus, depended the future of the Republic. A payment made in advance would have been a declaration of enmity with France. an undertaking which perhaps the emperor would never have started, and the defeat of the emperor by the French at that point would have exposed Florence to additional dangers. Leaving aside the events, it is important to understand how Vittorio Machiavelli responded to this specific question, which put in their hands the political future of Florence. What rules could be applied to make this political judgment? The question was real and demanded concrete answer. This case allows us to think in terms of political theory, attempting to clarify the processes that lead historically to the formulation of a political judgment. According to Machiavelli, the only possible way to understand the developments and the success of a political project was to think about politics going directly to the factual truth of the thing. These words, taken from the well-known 15th chapter of The Prince, contain the fundamental principles underlying all of Machiavelli's judgment. If for him it was no longer possible to make judgments according to the traditional theological and metaphysical ideas of their humanistic treatises on The Prince, much is due to these questions arising from concrete political problems. To answer to these questions, he needs to appeal the specific skills of a diplomat, or in the words of Guicciardini, to resort the discretion that cannot be learned from books. "It is necessary that you judge the facts," wrote the magistracy of Ten, "and we abandon ourselves totally to you." Machiavelli and Vettori think over the answer to give to the Ten and eventually write a letter on February 8, 1508. In that letter, we find already a first draft of a political treatise. There is already a part of The Prince, who years later Machiavelli would have presented exactly to Vettori, who must not have been too astonished to find in those pages the traces of their previous discussions. This is what they wrote to the Ten. "I would ask the wisest man in the world what he would do if he were charged with such a commission as your lordships have devoted upon me. I do not say this because I lack either faith or courage to execute the commission with which your lordships have honored me, but to show the difficulties of that commission, in execution of which no man, unless he be a prophet, can divine the right thing except by chance. For whether it be attempted to judge in detail according to what is seen from day to day or on general principles, one cannot arrive at any definite knowledge. But we must pay attention to this word but, because it is the word along with the word nonetheless that defines the realistic style of the prince. However, Vittorio Machiavelli, as required by the Ten, respond that if you must judge about this topic, you need to do the following. But I do know that if anyone desires to judge according to the rules of reason, volendo vedere secondo ragione, whether a man will be victorious in such an enterprise, he must take into consideration the number and quality of the troops which such individual has, and his means of keeping them together, and how govern himself as well as his forces. On these rules of reason, Machiavelli constructed the prince. Even the style of the letter is the same adopted in his treatise. No one doubts, they wrote, but what the emperor has plenty of soldiers and of good quality, but how we'll keep them together, there is the doubt. And as to the personal conduct of the emperor, I will only say that it cannot be denied that he is an active and careful man, most skillful in the art of war, but he is so good and human a gentleman that he has to become too easy and too credulous. So there are great doubts as to the success of his enterprise. In chapter 16 of The Prince, Machiavelli wrote, thinking evidently of these judgments, "It would be good to be held liberal. Nonetheless, liberality, when used so that you may be held liberal, arms you." Thus, even in the letter, there emerged an image of an emperor, considered a man of great experience, who has earned more credit than any of his forefathers. And yet, and mind you, this is considered a defect in politics, he is so good and human lord. The goodness in this case is therefore presented as an obstacle to a successful policy. Desiring to complete and with success his enterprise, he must learn not to be good, Machiavelli suggests. He needs to change his nature, as he wrote in the report drafted at the end of his diplomatic mission. Here are the rules of reason on which to base his political judgment, rules that he had to discover judging alone and without being able to rely on any authority, as he wrote in his Discourses 158. The point is of being able to judge. It is up to us, so, to judge our princes and our political leaders as he judged those of his time, seeking our criteria of judgment. To us, this work requires not to abandon our capacity of political judgment and our ability to learn to think about ourselves. Thank you.
Thank you very much.